I have been embracing an alternative lifestyle and imbibing the healing powers of woo-woo crystals through my fingertips. I am healed, and you could be too.
Who is this?
I'm looking at quizzical faces. Don't worry, I haven't gone completely potty. This will make sense. Well,
in your head,
maybe it won't make sense, but I can explain myself at least. So if you're a member of the Linux Matters Telegram channel, which you can find at linuxmatters.sh/telegram, you may have seen chat about precisely sized balls or spheres over the last few weeks. And this is the episode that explains what's going on. And first of all, I need to say some thank yous. So thank you to Simon, who's helped with the research of woo-woo crystals and introduced me to the term woo-woo crystals, who I think might be a keen collector of woo-woo crystals, given time and space to do so, not forgoing the fact that woo-woo crystals have varying prices based on the amount of woo-woo that they can project. Also to Stuart for finding some balls, which I'll get to later. And also thanks to my fellow lefties, Esme and Peacemaker, for their words of encouragement, and also for recognizing the daily injustice that us 10% go through with things like rulers and ring binders and potato peelers and calipers and fountain pens and things of other natures. Excluding, of course, classic arcade machines, which are obviously set up to favour the left-handed. And prior to the advent of tax-dodging billionaires, we were also most likely to become astronauts. And also, Peacemaker, quick message to you. I wasn't ghosting you. You did guess this right. This segment is about trackballs. And that is the alternative lifestyle that I have embraced, because I have switched from traditional mouses to trackballs.
Wow, we got there.
I thought we'd stumbled into an episode of This Is Your Life.
So I've had an achy arm for some years, it turns out, and I thought, okay, how can I address this? I've had physiotherapy, and I thought I'd give trackballs a try, because I have heard that they can relieve RSI and carpal tunnel and things like that. And going into this research, I thought this was going to be one of those usual tech rabbit holes where there's a bazillion things to research. But actually, it turns out that the trackball ecosystem is rather small, and there's a website, trackballmouse.org, and pretty much everything you need to know is on that one website, with a couple of exceptions, but pretty much everything you can learn is on that website and some reviews that they've done on YouTube. So I thought, I'm going to give trackballs a go. And I've tried a couple, and I've settled on a choice. And it's been an interesting journey.
So what is it about a trackball as opposed to a mouse that helps with an achy arm?
Two things. One is that it's entirely controlled by your fingertips, so you don't have to have sort of the same extension of your wrists or lateral and forward and backward motion as you're moving the mouse around. And there's a change in the way that your grip is for doing things like clicking the buttons and things of that nature. But it's mostly to do with, like, you have a large ball to manipulate with your fingertips rather than moving your whole wrist around on the desk.
Can I just point out, I don't have this situation because I use a track point, which also is only controlled with your fingertips.
Maybe that is also a legitimate
alternative lifestyle. Yes.
Yes, indeed. And to follow on from just using your fingertips, one of the other benefits of a trackball, specifically ambidextrous trackballs, is that you can move the trackball between your left and your right hand. Uh-huh. And unlike a mouse, you can control a trackball equally well, left or right-handed, regardless of which hand is dominant in your particular case.
That's interesting.
Yes, which I didn't realize until I sort of started looking into this, that this was one of the ways that people diminish sort of, you know, the wear and tear, dare I say, on one wrist, you know, by moving a trackball between sides of their desk.
When you started investigating this, did anyone suggest the weird, freaky vertical mouse things where you hold your hand like in a handshaky position?
I used to use one of those.
Yeah, so I watched some videos that of people that have suffered with different sort of, you know, strain related injuries or, you know, repetitive strain injuries, and they've tried different things, and they talked about those, and they said that they weren't as good at alleviating the pain because you're still like rotating your wrist and it requires some movement, which is kind of unnatural to the way that the wrist works. And also the other option is a lot of trackballs these days are thumb operated. And that puts a lot of emphasis on just using your thumb. And also, that means in my case, I can't move the trackball from left to right hand, because if you choose one of the thumbball options, it is obviously designed to be operated in a particular side. So I opted for ambidextrous mice.
Got it.
So that means the ball is on the top of the thing.
The ball is on the top, yes.
Right.
This has led to a couple of interesting discoveries. The first is that the whole time that I've been using mice, which is getting on for over 40 years now, I have never, ever remapped the buttons on the mouse to suit like left-handed operation. I have always used my middle finger to
left click
and my index finger to right click. Even though I use the mouse in my left hand.
We are 6 minutes into this recording, and that's the weirdest thing you've said so far, I have to say. Middle finger, left click, and index finger, right click is, no.
I used to have one of those handshaky vertical mouses which had a button on each finger. So I would have the push in the mouse wheel was the forward button, and push in my thumb was the backward button.
Right.
Because I was used to having forward and backward, like in those directions. But then I also had three other buttons.
One of the reasons why I never changed this is that in my early career, I did tech support like a lot of people would have done. And so I was visiting people's desks. And so having to adjust to buttons being the wrong way round all the time was a massive pain. So I just gave up with it. All I had to do was move the mouse from the right side of the desk to the left side of the desk.
You'd push all the coffee cups out the way. And
right, exactly. Yeah. And so that's the way I have used mice. But this switch to trackballs has actually required that I map the buttons the right way round for the way I want to use it. And the tool that I'm using for that is a bit of software called Input Remapper.
Good name.
There's a number of ways you can tackle this. And the reason I've used Input Remapper is it's a graphical tool, and I've used it before. I've used it for mapping keyboard to game controller inputs for games that have only got keyboard inputs that I want to remap to the controller, including my own original Anzi Alien Attack, which is the shell script shoot 'em up. But by using Input Remapper, you can enable and disable different profiles. So what that means is I can have it on the left side, and then when I want to move the trackball to the right side of the desk and use my right hand, I can just disable the left-handed button remapping. And now the trackball is correctly buttoned up for the right-handed use. So Input Remapper is a tool that I recommend not just for this use, but if you need to map any kind of input to any other device, it's a really great tool to do that, and it's all UI driven.
So how does this lead on to you buying expensive balls off the internet?
Well, yes. I've tried two different trackballs, and the first one that I tried is called the L-Track trackball, and that's made by a company called X-Keys. Now, they've had different names in the past, and I think the L-Track design has been around for decades and is predominantly used in like the broadcast industry. So in audio and video broadcasting studios where you have like a fixed desk of stuff. So consequently, they're unfortunately very expensive. In fact, I would say overpriced for what they are. When I took it apart, it was very much reminiscent of my QuickShot 2 Turbo joystick from 1985. There is no way the components or the bill of materials in this thing any way command the price tag that they go for. I think this is classic. It's designed for broadcasting, therefore they get to add another zero to the cost of the unit. But what I noticed when I was using the L-Track trackball is they very clearly advertised the diameter of the ball in the trackball, which is precisely 57.15 millimeters. And for those of you in America, that is 57.15 millimeters. And that is a very familiar measurement to me, because if you go and get Grandad's calipers out of the garage and measure that, it is also 2¼ inches, which is the diameter of a regulation-sized American pool ball. And the reason why this is familiar to me is that I am married to a rather keen pool player, and in life before children, our daughter's bedroom was our pool room. So I'm familiar with these dimensions, and I thought, well, this is interesting. I like to modify and customize my computer equipment and peripherals. Maybe I could fancy up the trackball in my trackball mouse by using something other than the ball it came with.
So have you now got an 8-ball as your trackball?
Well, that was my initial thought. Turns out lots of people on the internet have done the 8-ball thing, and I didn't want to do something that was a well-trodden path. So I went to the loft and I got one of the training balls from the selection of pool equipment that we have, and I plopped that into, well, I had to this particular trackball, you have to sort of unscrew and then insert the ball, but I did that, and lo and behold, it is a precise fit. So it is exactly the American pool ball size, and this training pool ball worked extremely well. It was slightly heavier than the ball that came in the thing, which actually was quite good for a bit more precise movement, and it looked interesting. And then because of the way my stupid brain worked, it occurred to me that there must be quite a lot of tooling in the world that can produce spheres that are precisely 57.15 millimeters in diameter. That was the point at which I started researching, well, what other spheres can I get to customize this trackball with more interesting balls? Which leads us on to woo-woo crystals. So you can buy crystals of all shapes and sizes, including precise diameter spheres. So I was able to acquire a blue sandstone woo-woo crystal that was 57 millimeters, and use that to customize the mouse to make it look a bit more interesting.
Are they sold as woo crystals, or are they sold as comedy billiard balls that explode when your cue ball hits it?
These are genuinely sold as healing crystals that happen to be spheres.
Well, it's healing your arm, so you know it's doing something, right?
Well, I am recovered as a result of this switch to trackballs. I'm not sure I can attribute it to woo-woo crystals specifically, but I did try out this sandstone ball and another one which was something else. And whilst they work, the thing is they are obviously hewn out of stone, and I think then sort of dropped in some resin to sort of finish them to get them to a particular, you know, size. But nevertheless, there's sort of bits of this that are rock, and they're a little bit grindy when you drop them into the trackball. So whilst they technically fit and they work, they're not an ideal choice. So at this point, definitely the training pool ball or an 8-ball if you have one, or, you know, any other regulation size American pool ball was the best option.
I would love to hear feedback from our listeners on what other ludicrous materials you could make a ball out of. I mean, glass sounds good, but I'm sure the surface will be a bit pitted. But I don't know, what, like, put sandpaper on the outside of the ball? I mean, I don't know, what's the daftest ball you would have?
Well, enter Stuart Langridge with his suggestion.
He is a daft ball, yes.
Stuart, doing some research, found that you could buy collectors' Dragon Balls balls. And they, because I think they are made from the same acrylic that cheap pool balls are made from, are also 57.15 millimetres. So a quick visit to AliExpress and £3 later, I ordered a Dragon Ball.
Wow.
Which is exactly the same dimensions and weight as a pool ball and works brilliantly and has the added benefit of having a bunch of stars inside it. So this is a great option for customizing your track ball with something a bit glitzy. And the L-Track track ball that I have has an LED beneath it that illuminates upwards. So it actually illuminates this amber Dragon Ball very nicely. So this was a win. So there's a nice way to customize your trackball. And as you say, Alan, I was thinking, well, what else could you have a sphere made out of that's precisely the right dimensions?
Lead shot.
Lead shot, almost. Almost. If you do some searching for sort of precision balls, you will find high precision solid metal balls, which are large ball bearings in all sorts of shapes and dimensions, including 57.15 millimeters. So, now I'm just going to have to hold on to my microphone for a minute, because I have a 600 gram solid steel, highly polished precision metal ball, which I'm holding up to the camera that my co-hosts can see right now.
I assume that crushes all of the internal components of the trackball to a fine dust when you put that in.
No, it doesn't actually. It sits in its cradle quite nicely. It moves around correctly. It doesn't grind like woo-woo crystals. But unfortunately, the 600 grams means it's almost impossible to move with your fingertips. And so when you saw me pick this up, this wasn't a wasted purchase, because what this is actually doing is it sits on top of my microphone stand and it counterbalances this microphone so it doesn't fall over as I talk to you. So it was an interesting experience, but I don't recommend high precision solid steel balls for your trackball.
Well, you have, you know, killed two birds with one ball, I guess, maybe.
Possibly.
I hope that you put pictures in the show notes for everyone to see your shiny balls.
I haven't put my shiny balls in the show notes, but those of you that are in the Telegram channel have been treated to the unboxing and photos of the different balls that I have received over the last few weeks or so. So we've talked about this L-Track trackball, which is too expensive and it's kind of good. It has a traditional scroll wheel, but the one that I've actually settled on is a Kensington Slim Blade Pro trackball. And one of the things I like about that, it has an interesting mechanism for scrolling pages. So unlike the L-Track, which has something akin to sort of a traditional scroll wheel that you would have on a mouse, the Kensington Slim Blade Pro has a mechanism where you sort of rotate the trackball around its equator and it scrolls up and down the page. And it has a similar sort of tactile feedback to breaking into a safe, a bit like that time I was involved in a bullion heist in 1983. But it's very, very good, and a lot cheaper than the L-Track.
This episode is sponsored by Tailscale, but please don't skip. I want to tell you how I use Tailscale's free plan to securely share remote access to web applications I'm prototyping on my laptop. Sometimes I want to test those web applications from other platforms, such as mobile devices. With the tailscale serve command, I can share a link to my creations on any other device on my tailnet. I have tailscale installed on all my devices, so I can access my prototype app from any device securely and without fuss. And if I want to share my creation with friends, colleagues, and customers, I can use the tailscale funnel command, which gives my application a public URL for as long as I need until I close the funnel. It made authenticating my app with GitHub easy because I could use the public tailscale link as the callback URL. No need for router port forwarding, and SSL is automatically enabled by default. Both tailscale serve and tailscale funnel are handy for developers like me. Many of the late night Linux family hosts are using Tailscale on their devices to secure cross-device networking, and you could too, because Tailscale's personal plan will always be free. To support the show and become a web developer like me, try Tailscale for free today. You'll get up to 100 devices and 3 users for free with no credit card required at tailscale.com/linuxmatters. That's tailscale.com/linuxmatters. You may recall in episode 45, I talked about how much I enjoyed a piece of software called Savannah, and I wanted to make some changes. And I started developing a gigantic pull request in order to package it up in a Docker container. Well, I scrapped all that because it was like unwieldy. And the problem I identified is that there are lots of changes that I want to make to this somewhat old code base. And by old, I mean like 3 or 4 years, but I can't really do it all in one giant PR. So I had a conversation with Michael Hall recently, who's the original author of Savannah. And I said, would you accept a pull request that just bumps slightly some dependencies and maybe lifts it up to a slightly more modern version of Python than Django? And then another pull request, which lifts it a little bit higher. And then a final one that will get you all the way to the very latest of, you know, everything, so that we're up to date and we're not carrying around a bunch of old dependencies. And then after that, do whatever packaging or bug fixes or features that I want to do, but lift it first before doing any of the container stuff. And he said, yeah, that sounds more sensible. Now, the fly in the ointment is that the master branch, if you go to the repo, the master branch doesn't actually work. And I couldn't get it working, and I was very confused. I mentioned this in episode 45, where Michael said, oh no, I run production off the production branch, not the master branch. And one of the things he requested is when I do my pull request to lift everything, he said, can you merge production into master, because they've diverged. Like production, he's done a bunch of, I don't know, feature development for production for his SaaS deployment of Savannah that is not in the master branch. He said, could you merge them? And I said, yeah, sure, no problem.
How hard could that be?
Well, indeed, yes, how hard could that be? Actually, it turns out not that hard. I learned a few things. One, I thought, well, how different are those two things? And I used a graphical utility called Beyond Compare, where it's like meld, and you get like two windows side by side, a bit like Midnight Commander kind of thing. And you open one branch. So I cloned the repository into two separate folders, and I looked at the differences in all the files between production and master. And I could see the additional features that have been added to the production branch that weren't in master. So it was quite a nice visual aid to see all the things that have been changed.
It's Beyond Compare for macOS.
Well, I happened to download it on my work macOS machine. I believe it might be available for other platforms as well.
Okay. I've got a feeling that Meld is inspired by Beyond Compare.
Oh, really? Interesting.
I think so.
I think it's paid for software. You like use it for like a few days and it nags you. Anyway, I just wanted to get a visualization of what it looks like. And once I got that, I thought, how am I going to best merge those changes? And it turns out it's actually really easy. I sat in the directory and just did a git diff between the two of the, you know, the changes, and turned that into a patch and applied that patch to the master branch. And that pretty much did everything I needed. So that was the first step, was like lifting the master branch in sync with what had landed in the newer production branch, right? And that was all well and good, but I was having to test this every so often, like try starting the thing up with a SQLite database or a Postgres database to see if it worked, because it's all very well we just merging all that stuff in. I actually have to test the thing to make sure that I haven't broken it. And it was a bit of a challenge because I had to hack a little bit and update a few dependencies here and there and tweak some code. And I had to remove some code because it was no longer supported. And I found myself doing this a few times, going through the loop of tweaking things, then using pip to install the dependencies, and then creating a database, and then inserting some data into the database so that I could test, and launching the app and then testing it. And I got to the point where I was iterating on it so much, I thought, well, I might as well script this. So I wrote a script, and the script does the application of the patches and then does all the changes that I want and applies the various changes to the requirements.txt to lift the various packages up and then tries starting the database. And I wrote this script to be able to test both SQLite and Postgres as a backend database for this thing, so that I could start from scratch at any time if there were any tweaks that I realized needed doing, like changes to the source or more requirements or something. I didn't want to hack on it directly in a directory because I didn't trust myself to get a pull request that would be like trustworthy. I wanted something that was clean, that I knew if you cloned the repository, patched, added the dependencies and built it, it would be fine. And so I had this script that I could just run and it would wipe the directory and start all over again and apply all my changes. And I got to the point where that worked. And then I created another pull request, which lifts it up to like Python 3.12. And then I've got another one in the works that lifts it up to Python 3.13. And along the way, there's a lot of like little dependencies here and there that need changing. And there's some code that needs changing as behavior changes between one version of Django and another, and one version of Python and another. And then various libraries need updating. But I found myself using these scripts to iterate on it a lot faster, so that I could just add an extra line into the script to say, okay, now you need to patch this file, or now you need to add this dependency, or install the Python dependencies in a particular order to make them work, like set up tools first and, you know, update pip and then update Python and then update Django in that order, then do pip install requirements, that kind of thing. So I scripted that. And so now I've got three scripts that if I run them one after the other, you'll get three branches that I can push. And so I push them to my repo on GitHub and then explained what I'd done to Michael and said, look, this is as far as I've got, is get as far as 3.12 and Django 5.1 or something, when it was on 3.1 or something like that. It was quite old. And I felt a kind of a minor sense of achievement. I've got that far.
Yeah, that's pretty fantastic. So I was going to say, it sounds like you've sort of created quite a robust test harness there that gives you the confidence to iterate and move forward, because you know that if the script does the right thing, you're golden.
Right. And it does all the necessary patching. It starts off by cloning the repo, checking out the branch that I'm starting point. Because I've got three of these scripts, they each start from a different branch, the previous branch, and then create a new branch and then start doing all their changes and then launch things and then ninja the database to add some data. And then you launch the browser and see if it works. And it does things like generate new passwords and fill in empty API keys where necessary and all that kind of stuff. So it's pretty robust. But I found it actually quite enjoyable. It was not really doing any Python. It was doing a bunch of shell scripts to like iterate on this. But I found that actually quite satisfying, to get to a point where I knew I could take a branch and run the script and take myself all the way through to a later release. Now, this means Michael's got a few pull requests to, or will have a few pull requests to review. And my goal is to get to the very latest and then add standard GitHub actions like Dependabot, if it's not already enabled, to make sure we keep those things up to date, and then go through some of those issues and feature requests and start adding things, and my own personal requirements as well, because part of this is self-serving, because I've got a bunch of features that I would like to see landed, and I can't really contribute to the production branch because it's so old and I can't even run it, and I would rather it was up to date before I contributed anything. And so that's my ultimate goal, is to contribute actual fixes to it.
You mentioned one of the steps there is open the browser and see if it works. Have you considered automating that with a tool like Selenium?
I hadn't actually, because I'm not doing a huge amount there. I'm basically making sure I can log in and things like images render. So as part of my tests, I actually add additional Python packages to like cache the images. It isn't put in the requirements.txt. It's part of my deployment, right? And so I would probably do that if I was creating the Docker container or if I was deploying this myself, but I wouldn't bake that in because other people might deploy it differently with Nginx or something else. So really opening the site in a browser and noodling around was really just to make sure that I hadn't messed the database up and the UI looked all right and it like started. And yeah, it did amazingly. So I'm quite looking forward to that. Like stage one, get to there. And then stage two will be going through my little wish list of features that I'd like to add, additional reports that I want Savannah to generate, additional data I want it to gather. There's sources that I would like it to gather data from. I mentioned Mastodon, Blue Sky, and other places I would like it to get data from. But we'll have to wait and see. And part of me thinks, if the upstream developer doesn't want these patches, what do? Do I maintain my own fork and do I keep it all in that? And that just like weighed heavy on my brain. So I'm hoping I can get these things landed so other people can contribute and the outstanding issues that haven't been addressed can be picked up by, you know, other Python and Django developers.
Linux Matters is part of the Late Night Linux family. If you enjoy this show, then please consider supporting us and the rest of the Late Night Linux team using the PayPal or Patreon links you can find at linuxmatters.sh/support. For $5 a month on Patreon, you can enjoy an ad-free feed of our show. Or for $10, get access to all the Late Night Linux shows ad-free. We love to get your feedback via email, show@linuxmatters.sh, or you can chat with us and other listeners in our Telegram group. All the details are available at linuxmatters.sh/contact.
I've been running a new office suite.
Oh.
I don't use an office suite terribly heavily these days. When I edit text, I just tend to do it in Markdown. I don't really use a word processor. But one thing I do still use is spreadsheets. I do a lot of, you know, household budgeting and things like that in spreadsheets. And it's the kind of thing where I always want to have it available to be able to check or update without having to necessarily whip out my laptop and find the particular file on and whatever state my laptop is in at the moment, whether it's working or not.
So you've upgraded to Lotus 1-2-3, yes?
Yes, quite. I have had various attempts at doing this in the past in having some sort of self-hosted web-based spreadsheet solution. I did at one point have a Drupal site with a JavaScript plugin for doing spreadsheets, which kind of worked. I've tried numerous times to get Nextcloud Office running on my Nextcloud server, but for whatever reason, I could never get that to happen.
Interesting, because at a previous employer, we had that deployed, Nextcloud, and I was amazed how well that Office suite ran. I don't think it was LibreOffice. I think we were using some OnlyOffice plugin for Nextcloud.
Right.
And it was surprisingly good. It was like not really any discernible difference from using Google, you know, or some other web-based thing like Office 365. I was quite impressed.
Yes. So at my current workplace, we are using Nextcloud Office, but it's not that slick. It's a bit janky, as we found, especially if you start trying to do, you know, like multiplayer notepad type activities. So I, in fact, tried out OnlyOffice with Nextcloud, running it locally, and it works very well. So this is now my home office solution, is OnlyOffice connected to Nextcloud.
Oh, I was surprised. I didn't think you were going to say that. I thought you were going to like find some weird esoteric office suite, but actually, how was the actual deployment?
So there's several different components of OnlyOffice. The one that matters to me is the document server. So that's what actually deals with the editing and providing the web editor, essentially, which you connect to Nextcloud. Nextcloud then becomes your document library. So you go in via Nextcloud, you find a file, you edit it, and then it opens the Office application in your browser. And it looks and feels quite a bit like Microsoft Office or Google Sheets. And I think I would say that it is probably, compared to LibreOffice or Nextcloud Office, a more compelling option if you have someone in your life or in your professional area who is looking to move to a self-hosted option away from, you know, having everything in Google. I would say for that reason, it's a very good option. But the other reason being is that its primary document format is the Microsoft Office Open XML formats.
That's convenient.
Ah, so interchangeable with the common platform.
Exactly.
And does it render correctly?
It seems to. I've not gone that far into advanced features, but you know, it is designed to work with those formats primarily. So, you know, when you say to someone, oh, there's this alternative Office suite you can host yourself, and they say, oh, well, will it work with my documents? The answer isn't, well, no, but you can, there's this other completely different document format you've never heard of that you can convert all your documents to. It's, yes, it will, which I think is quite nice.
So you've talked about the fact that only Office integrates with Nextcloud, and Nextcloud is the document store. But at sort of a practical level, what are the things you're connecting together here? Are these containers or packages? Like, how did you actually glue this together?
So my Nextcloud is running in a snap, and I have deployed OnlyOffice as part of my Docker cluster with all of my other self-hosted applications. You can also deploy the OnlyOffice document server as a snap. I just chose not to, because on the server where I'm running it, I'm running everything with Docker. And then it's just essentially a web service between the two. You go into Nextcloud and you say, here's the server URL and here's the secret that you use to access the API. And it kind of just works from there.
I may be dreaming, but was the way it works, it renders like images that it sends to you. And what you're actually seeing is the delta changes of an image. It's almost like screen recording, like, or streaming a video of your Office application. It's not like sending you some data and then a JavaScript client on your local machine renders that as OnlyOffice.
I know that that was how the LibreOffice online version worked. At least it used to. I don't know if it still does. I'm not sure if OnlyOffice works in the same way or not. But another thing it does do is it has mobile apps, which are definitely doing something running locally on the phone, but you still log into your Nextcloud server. So you open OnlyOffice on your phone and it says, where is your document server? And you say, it's Nextcloud, here's the URL. And then you browse through your files on Nextcloud and it will open it in the mobile OnlyOffice interface.
Nice.
Yes.
And is this, you say this is family friendly and accepted by other members of the community?
I mean, to the extent that, you know, not many other people in my house use Office suites very much either.
Give it time.
So if you go to onlyoffice.com, it is very much focused to selling you their enterprise proprietary product. But the community edition, which is what I'm running in the Docker container, is supported for up to sort of 20 people using it at once. I don't know how much of a technical barrier that is, or if it's just a performance thing. It doesn't work very well when it's more than that. But as it's open source, if you were that way minded, I'm sure you could overcome that one way or another. But for a family or a small office, it seems like that's a very viable option. And then they've got, you know, they'll sell you commercial plans beyond that as well. But certainly from my use case, it's very good and seems to work very well.